The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey everybody, so it is definitely time to get you a C-Realm Vault episode, and in terms of the amount of work, there are easier ways to go than reading something to you, because it does involve some editing. But in terms of having to think of something, well, there's really nothing easier than just finding something that's really worth sharing and sharing it with you. So what I have for you here is a piece on a very important topic. It came to me via the C-Realm Podcast Discussion Group on MeWe.com. And, you know, in recent episodes, I've talked about, the cosmic scale of reality, just how incredibly big things are. And consequently, by comparison or in context, how very, very small we are. And when you think about processes that play out over the course of millions and billions of years, like the formation of solar systems, the lives of stars, things like that, well, you know, what's a human life that's at most 100 years and probably quite a bit less than that? Well, from the perspective of the life of a star, which might last billions of years, the difference between 1 second and 100 years is really not worth mentioning. But from our perspective, you'd go to a lot of trouble and expense to live an extra 5 years if you could, right? Of course, another long-standing topic of interest is that of artificial intelligence. How fast is it coming? Is it coming at all? How will we know when it arrives? What effects will it have? You know, Joe Rogan just recently interviewed Elon Musk. You probably heard about it because Elon Musk held a blunt in his hand briefly and drew a little bit of the smoke into his mouth and immediately exhaled it. He did not inhale at all, but apparently just that pantomime of taking a hit off a blunt caused the Tesla stock price to plummet. Well, plummet, lose a few points. But there is one topic which I come back to from time to time, which seems trivial. It seems like a break from the serious consideration to basically just dwell on something that is mind candy. But really, so many of the issues, particularly issues relating to human consciousness, come together under the heading of this one topic. What topic is that? You got it. Sex robots. I'm going to read a piece from Jacobite Mag. This is back from April of this year, April 24th. It's called Uncanny Vulvas by Diana Fleischman. Diana Fleischman writes, "Sex is consistently underrated as a driver of innovation. Yes, space exploration helped us to develop the technology for things like cochlear implants, powdered machine lubricants, and scratch-resistant lenses. Lust has furthered the development of cash transfers, point-of-view filming, and video chat. I predict that historians of the development of artificial intelligence are going to see sexual gratification as one of the phenomenon's great motivators. Evolutionary psychology can give us insights into how sex robots are going to develop and the ramifications they'll have on society. Sex robots are usually woman-shaped, gynoid machines. At the present time, sex robots are simple. They're silicon sex dolls that have some capacity for movement and response. Manufacturers are rolling out new models and new promises. Sex robots that respond to touch and penetration, sex robots with interchangeable faces and bodies, and sex robots with different personalities. Sex robots will have all the allure of the cues of fertility in a flesh-and-blood woman combined with the artificial intelligence that creates compulsive reward-directed behavior." Think of how skillful the programmers of social media algorithms have become in basically keeping our attention and keeping us focused on clicking, clicking, clicking on a screen to refresh that screen to show us more ads and make more money for them. And they can't even touch us, not physically. Obviously, that was an aside for me. Returning to the text, sex robots are overwhelmingly gynoid because heterosexual men drive the market for sexual products like prostitution and pornography. Across cultures, men desire more sexual partners, need to know someone far less time before they want to have sex with them, and have lower standards for a sexual liaison than women.
For most men, and especially Anakin, a 19-year-old male with raging hormones, the list of what he's looking for in a relationship is rather short.
Number one, is she hot? Number two, seriously, bro, how hot is she?
And that's it. Now, what women are looking for is a little more complex. Their list is as follows.
Does he have a good job? Where does he live and what kind of car does he drive?
He needs to be confident without being too arrogant. He needs to be funny, but not like goofy funny. He needs to be tall, but not too tall or like weird tall.
He should be spontaneous, but only when I'm expecting it.
Handsome is a plus, and handsome with good hair is better. No baldies, LOL. He needs to know the exact time to say all the right things.
He needs to know the right time not to say anything.
He really needs to know how to treat me like the woman I am, both in the bedroom and when we're out on the town. He needs to be family-oriented and good with kids, but not too good with kids, like in a creepy clown way.
He needs to be intelligent, or at the very least, money smart, so we can know how to invest for retirement, the kids' college fund, and our funeral expenses. He can have his friends and do things with them, but only when it's convenient for me.
He needs to care about me, but not be too controlling. You know, sometimes I just want to go out and have fun with the girls, and he needs to be okay with that, and not
okay,
get all like,
stop.
Hey, where
Thank
are you
Thank you, that'll
going?
Be all. Then the list goes on to 167, but I'll stop there, you get the point. Now, when first courting a woman, she'll be interested in two things. That you don't look like Danny DeVito, and that you say and do all the right things.
Across cultures, men desire more sexual partners, need to know someone far less time before they want to have sex with them, and have lower standards for a sexual liaison than women. Looking at gay men is instructive here. Their sexual interactions are not limited by women's sexual choosiness, and they, on average, have many more sexual partners than straight men or lesbians. It isn't hard to see the reason for this. Men don't get pregnant and don't lactate, and they have smaller, easier-to-produce sex cells than women. For a man, the cost of producing offspring is cheap. Getting one's genes into the next generation is the engine of evolution. The low opportunity costs make men motivated to take every opportunity, even if it comes in the form of a robot. Ever think a dog is dumb for growling at his reflection in the mirror? Human men can become aroused looking at flat images of nude women in black and white. Our evolved psychology can respond in maladaptive ways toward novel stimuli. Again, think social media. Courtship is expensive and complicated by design, and it's the limiting factor of the sexual fulfillment of men. Women impose costs on men to gain sexual access for very good reasons. To test their genetic fitness and their long-term potential supporting a family. If courtship is costly and the costs are not clearly defined, this not only tests a man's motivation toward a specific woman, it also acts to monopolize a man's resources, so he can't afford to woo anyone else. Pornography and prostitution are popular because they arrive at sexual end goals, or a reasonable facsimile, with more clarity and lower costs than in the mating market. The complications of courtship are driving improvement in sexual substitutes, like masturbation aids. For example, Fleshlight, Fliphole, and 3D porn. There are already thousands of real dolls in the world, silicone sex dolls that cost around $5,000 each. Love Plus is a Japanese game in which players interact with a virtual girlfriend, including kissing her by touching the screen and taking her out on dates, has hundreds of thousands of users. Love Plus is a great demonstration of how this market isn't only about providing sex, but also virtual companionship. You can't even have virtual sex with Rinko, the ingenue of the game. These substitutes aren't very good, and yet they're already competing with flesh-and-blood companionship. Union power, increases in mandatory working standards, and minimum wage laws accelerate the push toward automation. Machines are already replacing cashiers and factory workers. Soon, truck drivers, clerks, and accountants will meet an unfavorable future, too. The current political climate around courtship and interactions between the sexes is more powerful than the market forces that are replacing jobs, because escalating costs aren't transparent, and neither is the punishment for not paying them. If a business owner wants to adhere to employment laws, he reads them. The costs of courtship are codified nowhere. The average single man paying attention to contemporary social fashions will struggle to understand the new rules of meeting, courting, and having sex with women. Something as banal as trying to converse with a woman wearing headphones is now often considered harassment. A man's chances of mating success increase when he approaches many women, but so too do his chances of gaining a reputation as sexist, exploitative, or immoral. To take a fraught example, how does a man know that a woman is genuinely consenting to sex? A lack of ability to pick up on cues can incur catastrophic costs. Men, high in conscientiousness, who are sensitive to social disapproval but who nonetheless have difficulty reading subtle social cues, could make good husbands for women. These men are unlikely to want to take the risk of approaching women. As substitutes like sex robots and virtual companions become better and cheaper, they will monopolize the attention of such men. Think of an introverted engineer with Asperger's syndrome who wasn't sure how to breach a conversation with a woman back in 2015 and definitely isn't sure how to do it in today's climate. In 10 years, he could have a beautiful robot companion. Indeed, he could have one that could emulate the experience of having sex with dozens of different women, that has a lower barrier to entry than the mating market, and that keeps him satisfied enough to remain a happy bachelor. Some woman misses out on a conscientious guy with a good income, who might not know exactly how to respond when she says, "Nothing's wrong," but will definitely keep the cars tuned up and get the kids to their mathematics championships. The world might miss out on his sons and daughters and their analytical approaches to some of the world's problems. The kinds of men described above, who have difficulty reading social signals but who are nonetheless strongly sexually motivated, have a characteristic that means they'll be less put off by sex robots than the average person: resistance to perceiving the uncanny valley. The uncanny valley is the way that representations that fall just short of looking like humans often look creepy. Anthropomorphized robots are more relatable and trustworthy than machine-like robots. It's also difficult to imagine that many people would want to have sex with a conglomeration of gears and wheels. My view is that the uncanny valley is something analogous to Capgras delusion, a psychological disorder that causes sufferers to believe that someone they know has been taken over by an imposter, often inhuman. According to V.S. Ramachandran, there are two aspects to recognizing faces: the identification of the external familiar representation and the internal validation, the warm emotion that goes along with it. In the uncanny valley, you recognize a robot as human-like, but it's missing the facial movement or some other characteristic that gives you a warm feeling of recognition. Many men won't experience the uncanny valley, especially with regards to sex robots. These men are going to be the early adopters. Men are worse at identifying faces than women, and are far more likely to have prosopagnosia, the inability to recognize faces. Sex is weird. Sex is gross and awkward. Natural selection addresses this issue by causing arousal to attenuate the human disgust response. It's worth noting that men have a much lower baseline sexual disgust than women, and that sexual excitement further reduces disgust sensitivity in men. In a classic paper by Dan Ariely, aroused men had much more positive attitudes about all kinds of unusual sexual acts. Sexually aroused men were more likely to say that it would be fun to watch a woman urinating, and that they could imagine getting sexually excited by contact with an animal. 3D pornography of video game or cartoon characters that might be creepy in a non-sexual context are popular genres. The most direct evidence that men won't be put off by uncanny vulvas is from a paper that laments the, quote, "unabashed sexualization of female-gendered robots," close quote, in comments on YouTube videos of robots. Body comments on gynoids, "you'll have to replace it monthly due to semen corrosion," for example, were more frequent than comments expressing unease. Perhaps we should encourage some men to use sex robots. Men who get environmental cues that they're evolutionary dead ends disproportionately menace society. In the 1980s, evolutionary psychologist couple Wilson and Daly found that perpetrators of violence and homicide had something in common. They were young, single, and didn't have access to the kinds of resources with which to win mates. Polygamous societies in which wealthier men have access to multiple women are more violent and less stable because they have a class of young men without the prospect of getting a mate. Monogamy, rather than being the state of nature, may have been an important cultural technology for reducing violence. Men have much greater variance of reproductive success than women. Sometimes they get cues that they have nothing to lose and everything to gain from taking risks through violence, sexual or otherwise. This is one reason that pornography decreases the rate of sexual assault. When men get cues that women are interested in them, even if those women are mere representations, their evolved psychology leads them to less risky ways of attempting to achieve reproductive success. How many teenage boys would be able to build up the resentment to commit mass shootings or suicide if they had a beautiful sex robot at home? Importantly, this is distinct from Freudian catharsis or discharge theory. There isn't evidence that aggressive or sexual impulses can be purged by getting them out of your system. The motivation for these impulses is instead weakened by environmental cues that indicate you don't need to engage in risky strategies to achieve reproductive success. The cues a sex robot would provide to the evolved psychology of a previously disgruntled teenager would be, you're achieving incredible mating success and status by staying at home and playing video games. Keep at it. This feeling of achievement from merely staying at home, playing video games, and having sex with a robot is, of course, a double-edged sword. We could call this fake fitness, subjective cues of success without real-world ramifications. Society and education incentivize effort, with markers of status like diplomas, potentially means to an end for reproductive success. The men who would have been most likely to have access to multiple women throughout history were men high in status, like kings, and men high in dominance, like warlords. Video games and social media already undermine the native psychological mechanisms that make us work towards status. They supply more immediate rewards and take far less effort than anything we work towards out in the real world. Sex robots are only going to make that worse, especially for young men. The game Love Plus, in which the ultimate reward is simply getting to know a virtual girl and attaining her virtual signals of approval, has already replaced pursuing dating real women for thousands of men. Imagine if winning a video game was punctuated not with just saving the princess, but having sex with her. Imagine if men could have the diversity of sexual experience of Genghis Khan, Muhammad, or John F. Kennedy without actually achieving anything. Sex robots are about to make the virtual world even more alluring.
Ordinary human dating. It's enjoyable and it serves an important purpose. But when a human dates an artificial mate, there is no purpose, only enjoyment. And that leads to tragedy.
Neato, a Marilyn Monroe bot.
Ooh, you're a real dreamboat.
Billy Everteen.
Harmless fun? Let's see what happens next.
Billy, do you want to walk your dog?
No, thanks, Mom. I'd rather make out with my Monroe bot.
Billy, do you want to get a paper route and earn some extra cash?
No, thanks, Dad. I'd rather make out with my Monroe bot.
Billy, do you want to come over tonight? We can make out together.
Gee, Mavis, your house is across the street. That's an awfully long way to go for making out.
Did you notice what went wrong in that scene? Ordinarily, Billy would work hard to make money with his paper route. Then he'd use the money to buy dinner for Mavis, thus earning a slim chance to perform the reproductive act. But in a world where teens can date robots, why should he bother? Why should anyone bother?
What does this mean for women? When the sex ratio changes, so too do sexual norms. Sex robots are going to emulate an increase in the ratio of women to men. On university campuses, with a larger percentage of women relative to men, women are more likely to have casual sex. They're less likely to be virgins, and they're more likely to have negative attitudes about men. When there are more men than women, women are much less likely to have casual sex. The majority sex competes for the minority sex, and the minority sex calls the shots. A female majority competes with casual sex, and a male majority competes with long-term commitment. Sex robots will emulate a majority-women ratio, shifting women to compete for men's attention by requiring less courtship and commitment in exchange for sex. The long-term ramifications are unclear, especially the way long-term technologies and cultural norms will interact. Perhaps women will discover they have to make the costs of courtship both low and transparent to compete with sex robots. Or, perhaps, new technology could enable women to recombine their genes with one another, making men enamored with sex robots, or men generally, totally redundant. There has, unsurprisingly, been a feminist backlash to the development of sex robots. Quote, "Sex bots reinforce an incredibly dangerous idea, that women's bodies are only bodies, and exist for men's use," close quote, says the founder of Feminist Current, Megan Murphy. Kathleen Richardson, head of the Campaign Against Sex Robots, wants to stop the development of sex robots because she believes sex-bot-human relationships are unethical, due to the similarity to relationships between sex workers and clients, which she also wishes to abolish.
In the UK, I headed to London's Science Museum to meet Dr. Kathleen Richardson, robot ethicist and founder of the Campaign Against Sex Robots.
Do we want to keep perpetuating these ideas that justify the exploitation of people?
She argues that owning a sex robot is the same as owning a slave.
What these sex dolls do is they rest on an idea that women are property, that women are not fully human, they are subhuman. People say, well, it's just a masturbatory tool. But the people behind them, they're saying, no, you can have a relationship with this doll. It can be your girlfriend. It can be your wife. You know, in the future, you'll be able to marry these dolls. Sex is an experience of human beings, not bodies as property, not separated minds, not objects, but it's a way for us to enter into our humanity with another human being.
They say that what they're doing is just trying to make people happy, that their robots are therapeutic, that they're about creating an illusion of companionship for people who otherwise would not have a chance to have any companionship. What would you say to that?
It's a myth and it's a lie, actually. People and objects are not interchangeable. You cannot substitute a person with an object and think you're going to have the same thing.
So they're being kept alone, these people?
Yes, and the objects then start to fill the places of other human beings, of hurt feelings, of suffering, of despair, of loneliness. And I would call that part of rape culture. The more they participate in activities that are outside of this consensual framework, they then turn themselves into objects. This is not stopping. This is now a train that is going quickly and it's going at a speed that no one really understands.
Not all feminists agree with Murphy and Richardson. Kate Devlin endorses the development of sex robots but agrees that hypersexualized and subservient representations of women are problematic. Devlin wants to go beyond sex robot technology developed by men for men and believes sex robot technology should be steered in a progressive direction, beyond heteronormative and gendered depictions, including sexual robots designed for women's pleasure. Let me just pause here and state the obvious, really, that in a capitalist society, if women demonstrate that they will spend money on sex robots, entrepreneurs will build sex robots for women. But as the author of this piece has already pointed out, and as I think is intuitively obvious to just about everybody, it is the desire and the spending habits of men which will drive this technology. Returning to the essay, both camps underestimate the degree to which evolved psychology, rather than culture or technology, shape attitudes. If feminism had been as well developed during the advent of pornography or prostitution, would they look fundamentally different? Would there be a way of steering them in a progressive direction, to make them as appealing to women as they are to men? The technologies developed to satisfy sexual urges will always cater to masculine tastes and interests that are older than media and indeed humanity itself. Unless or until we live in a post-gender transhumanist society, men will be the drivers of sexual technologies and markets. Underpinning feminist anxiety is the specter of female replaceability. Having long been concerned with governing male desire, the feminist project now faces the possibility of being routed around. Men can build alternatives to a sexual market that has been made less navigable because of ideology. Substitutes are built and bargaining power dissipates. Sex robots are to gender politics as scabs are to labor relations. Facing one's own market-driven replaceability results in existential dread. But market innovation has already created something dreadful on the other side of the coin. A large segment of men that have no prospect of satisfying their most basic desires. French author Michel Houellebecq, and I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that, but there it is. It's H-O-U-E-L-L-E-B-E-C-Q. Have fun with that one. French author Michel H. wrote on the topic of sexual have-nots in his novel Whatever. Begin block quote from the novel. Just like unrestrained economic liberalism, and for similar reasons, sexual liberalism produces phenomenon of absolute pauperization. Some men make love every day, others five or six times in their life, or never. Some make love with dozens of women, others with none. It's what's known as the law of the market. In an economic system where unfair dismissal is prohibited, every person more or less manages to find their place. In a sexual system where adultery is prohibited, every person, more or less, manages to find their bedmate. In a totally liberal economic system, certain people accumulate considerable fortunes. Others stagnate in unemployment and misery. In a totally liberal sexual system, certain people have a varied and exciting erotic life. Others are reduced to masturbation and solitude. Economic liberalism is an extension of the domain of the struggle, its extension to all ages and all classes of society. sexual liberalism, is likewise an extension of the domain of the struggle, its extension to all ages and all classes of society. End block quote. Diana Fleischman continues, "The Fermi paradox is the unsettling idea that even though the chances of extraterrestrial life are extremely high, nobody else in the universe has contacted us or visited us. Fitness-faking technology, which delivers the cues of status and sexual popularity, is evolving much faster than our minds can evolve to contend with them. Imagine extraterrestrial civilizations in their millions with their own super-advanced alien sex robots, too busy with proximate rewards to contact, colonize, or destroy our little planet. In the shadow of desire-hacking technology, humans are going to need to get a sober view of sex differences, evolved motivations, and the best ways to exercise control to limit destruction and increase productivity." That is the end of the article or essay, and we are told that Diana Fleischman is an evolutionary psychologist working in the United Kingdom. Follow her on Twitter. And I did pop over to Twitter, and I see that she is following 497 people on Twitter, and that she has 28.7 thousand followers. And I have just added myself to their ranks. And if this topic is of interest to you, and you don't regularly listen to Sam Harris's podcast, I would recommend that you check out episode number 135, Navigating Sex and Gender, a conversation with Marty Hasselton, who describes herself as a Darwinian feminist. Much of the essay that I just read from Diana Fleischman had to do with what's called evolutionary psychology, basically exploring human motivations and human behavioral tendencies and incentives. That's evolutionary psychology, or also called sociobiology. And one of its early proponents, Edward O. Wilson, was viciously attacked by feminists in the 1970s and 1980s when he was first starting to talk about this topic. And that doesn't take a whole lot of explaining. I mean, people who take as a basic tenet of their ideology that there are no biological differences between men and women, that all differences, particularly behavioral differences, can be chalked up to cultural indoctrination. Well, you know, the whole notion that evolutionary pressures, which shaped the development of our body in response to our environment, might also have shaped our minds and behaviors. That's simply anathema to certain types of mainstream feminist thought. So when I first read this essay, I didn't really see who wrote it. And I was surprised in rereading it and, you know, going back to the top of the page and looking at the author that it was written by a woman. I had a girlfriend in the 90s who rejected the very notion of evolutionary psychology by saying, one, that it contradicted feminist theory, and that, two, it justified male philandering. And depending on your definition of justified, those could both be very true statements, particularly the first one. Now, before you rush off to listen to Waking Up Podcast, episode number 135, Navigating Sex and Gender with Marty Hasselton, let me say it's not even close to being the most engaging or interesting recent episode of that podcast. The most recent episode features a conversation with Jonathan Haidt, and before that, he talked with Jaron Lanier, somebody whose words and ideas have made many appearances on this podcast, although his voice has not. And something else that I've talked about a lot and examined from a variety of angles on this podcast has been the notion of universal basic income. And there's a guy named Andrew Yang, who is an advocate for universal basic income, who intends to run for president on the Democratic ticket in 2020. I doubt he's going to make the nomination. I doubt he will even really get the chance to debate any of the mainstream Democratic Party candidates. But that is his issue, universal basic income. So if that is a topic of interest to you, you might check out Waking Up Podcast episode number 130, which features a conversation with Andrew Yang. So I took some notes while editing my reading of Diana Fleischman's essay, and she has some great turns of phrase. I just love things like, too busy with proximate rewards to bother conquering our little planet. And also fake fitness. You know, there are signals that the environment gives to us which appeal to, you know, our evolved psychology. One of which is your status. You know, what you're doing. Is it bringing you social status? Because social status correlates with your ability to mate and pass on your genes. And sex robots, as well as a variety of other technologies, have the potential to create what Diana Fleischman calls fake fitness. The environment of young men, which is largely created and dominated by electronic media and often video games and other types of simulations and cybernetically structured activities, can communicate to young men subconsciously but very powerfully, You're achieving incredible mating success by staying home and playing video games. Keep it up. What I found kind of ironic about that is that in the current environment, the people who are actually the best video game players really do have all manner of mating opportunities. They have the means to have the sort of, the variety of sexual experience, maybe not of Genghis Khan, but certainly of somebody like John F. Kennedy or Tiger Woods. In fact, some of the highest paid athletes in the world are so-called e-athletes, which is to say people who play video games. On the Media recently had an episode in which they talked about the streaming service called Twitch. And one of the main application for Twitch is to allow people who are good at video games to stream their games to an audience while they play. And in the process, they are making comments, they can play with other people, and their banter is part of that stream. And the biggest video game players on Twitch have other celebrities basically approaching them and asking if they can, get on their stream and play games with them. But when my youngest son was here, he was here for a few weeks over the summer, he spent a lot of time playing Fortnite, which is a multiplayer online first-person shooter. Or I guess it's a third-person shooter since you can see your own character. But he spent a lot of time playing that online with a friend, and they were both basically trying to get into the very bottom tier of recognized ranked players. So for most guys who are staying home playing video games, even those who are doing it all day, every day, they're probably not going to really be all that good at them, at least not compared to the best players in the world. And, with information technology and distance and long distance communications and the ability to play games with and against people from around the world, well, the very best players in the world are going, their reputations are going to reach everybody, which means that, even pretty good players are not even going to rate, in the most minimal way. But that doesn't matter, because the games can be designed to basically tell you that, yeah, you're doing great. You are really racking up the status there. You are impressing the ladies, and you are going to have all manner of sexual experience as a result of what you're doing right now, which is to say, sitting on the couch, eating junk food, playing video games. This is just exactly what you need to do in order to get laid and pass on your genes, so keep at it. Now, I want to go back and touch on the comments of Kathleen Richardson. She's the one leading the campaign against sex robots, and she was saying that, that having a sex robot is identical to slavery. It's the moral equivalent of slavery. And I think people who are interested in peak oil, and I imagine everybody listening to this podcast is at least passingly familiar with the concept, if not somebody who has spent more than their share of time digging into the topic, is familiar with the notion of an energy slave, which is to say, living in the modern world with machines working to satisfy our biological needs and, our psychological needs and even our whims, we have access to the types of lifestyle and service that people in the past achieved by owning human slaves or, commanding the labor of others, even if the arrangement wasn't strictly speaking slavery. For example, serfdom. Serfs aren't slaves, but they're not free to determine their own course in life either. And they owe labor, specific types of labor, to the feudal lord. So for a good part of human history, I'd say for most of human history and prehistory, before the rise of monogamy, which, lots of people say is a form of tyranny, in the winner-take-all, in the winner-take-all sexual marketplace, basically certain men, strong men, dominant men, men of high social status, or men who are particularly adept at the use of violence or, coordinating the violent actions of others, they got a lot of opportunities to pass on their genes. They got to have sex with a lot of women. And other men either didn't have sex with very many women or didn't get to have sex at all. And as the author of this piece noted, young men, teenagers and men in their early 20s who are given signals from their environment that they are not sexually attractive and that they do not have the opportunity to have sex, they tend to get violent. They tend to be willing to use violence in ways that men who, have easy access to sex are not willing to do. And in our current environment, that leads to things like mass shootings, school shootings, and other acts, spectacular media-amplified acts of violence, which make the person who carries them out, at least for a very short time, a celebrity of sorts. But Kathleen Richardson was saying that when you try to substitute an object in place of a person, it's not really a one-for-one replacement, and it doesn't really get you what you need. You know, it doesn't really satisfy the human urge, the human desire for intimacy or for connection. You know, you're just getting off. But for a lot of young men, men who are told that, you know, if they approach a woman, if they signal sexual interest in a woman and she rejects them, that they can be held accountable, you know, and have their reputations smeared, their ability to make a living severely hampered, maybe fired from their jobs, possibly reported to the police for harassment. You know, if bad flirting becomes criminal, then more and more young men are just not even going to try. And we don't even have to project this into the future. I mean, as it currently stands, there are people, there are men who have sex every day. There are men who have sex with a variety of partners, but there are probably a lot more men who don't have sex at all, or, you know, who maybe get to have sex a handful of times over the course of their lives. And for them, a sex robot is not replacing a real human being with a device. It is replacing nothing with something. So I found Kathleen Richardson's arguments really disingenuous and very heartless. I mean, really, really heartless. Not just for the young men who don't get to have sex, but for the society that has to suffer the violence of young men who don't see any prospect of basically getting a girlfriend. They are willing to do things that guys with girlfriends are not willing to do. And those things are typically not very helpful. They are typically violent. They are typically destructive. But throughout history, you know, the violent tendencies of young men who aren't getting laid have been directed to warfare. They have been turned to the advantage of the men, you know, the powerful, charismatic men whose real strength, whose real aptitude is directing the violent impulses of other men. But monogamy, which introduces an unnatural constraint on our desire to connect with a variety of people, well, it's a trade-off, I think. As Diana Fleischman puts it in the essay, in a society where monogamy is the cultural norm, where cheating does have, you know, severe negative consequences, just about everybody finds a mate. But in a, you know, laissez-faire sexual environment where anybody can do anything they want, and there's no such thing as slut-shaming, and there is no penalty placed upon men for, you know, having sex outside of their supposedly monogamous relationships or for having sex with somebody other than the mother of their children, well, in such an environment, you get a result which is similar to what you get in capitalism. You know, some people amass enormous fortunes. Some people get to have a lot of sex. And other people live lives of enforced celibacy, involuntary celibacy. In internet lingo, these men, mostly men, identify themselves as incels, which is to say involuntary celibates. And involuntary celibates tend to be very, very angry, at least the ones who are, you know, motivated to post on places like Reddit. They're angry at the good-looking men, you know, the confident men, the men who, for whatever reason, gain sexual access to women, either one woman as a girlfriend or a variety of women. They're angry at the society which tolerates this unfairness, and they are, I think most of all, angry at women. Because it is essentially female selection, female mate choice, which drives the situation. Now, I realize that women certainly have reason to be resentful in a social situation where there is a lot of slut-shaming, where women are definitely punished for having multiple sexual partners, but when powerful men do it, you know, there's an understanding, there's a nod and a wink that the powerful man, the charismatic man, the successful man, who takes advantage of his status to have sex with a variety of women, well, you know, he's just considered to be top dog, the stud, the guy who's really got it going on. So in terms of that double standard, that really does seem to be an unfair situation for women. What I found interesting, or one of the many things, in fact, that I found interesting in this article was the discussion of the differences on college campuses. And, you know, there are some campuses, now, in the United States anyway, more women go to college than men do. And in fact, there has to be a preferential admissions practices to get as many men into college as they have, you know, as actually go to college. The educational environment in the United States and in other countries as well, but I mostly know the United States, is basically a better fit for women than it is for men. So much so that for many young men, as soon as they have completed their mandatory schooling, they want no more of it. I definitely felt that way in high school, and if it weren't for an odd and unlikely set of circumstances and coincidences, I never would have gone to college. In fact, in my senior year of high school, I've probably told you this, I joined the Marine Corps. That's where I was headed. But I am about to head over to the TV station, and I'm going to record a video, which I'm going to put up on YouTube and post links to it here and there. And it's going to be a follow-up to a couple of videos that I did last year on the topic of antinatalism. Antinatalism is the belief that it would be better not to have children, not to reproduce, better not to bring more people into the world. There are a variety of motivations, and I think some of them are overlapping motivations for adopting this belief. There's a variety of antinatalism called philanthropic antinatalism, which basically says that, you know, overpopulation causes humans to be, each individual human to be valued less. The fewer humans we have, the more valuable each one is. When there are fewer laborers, laborers have a bargaining advantage when it comes to, you know, negotiating a price for their labor. When there are more people than there are opportunities for gainful employment, well, the result is economic misery and desperation. And so the fewer people there are in the world, the better the lives of those people. So goes the philanthropic antinatalist argument. Then there's the mythanthropic antinatalist argument, the one that just says humans suck, humans are terrible. You know, we are cruel to ourselves, we're cruel to each other, we're devouring the planet, we despoil everything. The world would be better off without us and we should all die. And if, you know, we're not all going to commit suicide or mass murder of one variety or another, the least we can do is just not reproduce. That when we die, we should reduce the human load on the environment by one. And if that is your position, either the philanthropic or the misanthropic position, if you think that it would be better for humans to have fewer children, then you should be all for sex robots. Because sex robots are going to, as Diana Fleischman put it, basically signal reproductive success to people who aren't actually having sex with other humans and thus are not making any new humans. Basically, it short-circuits the human sex drive as something that contributes to overpopulation, or even the reproduction of existing populations. More sex robots means fewer babies. And if you're an antinatalist, that is good news. I like that she worked in the Fermi paradox there toward the end. I mentioned this in a conversation with Adam Grubb on the Greening the Apocalypse radio show and podcast. You know, we talked about aliens, and I think I have shared with you the end of the short story, Blood Music, which basically tells the story of a biotech singularity, which opens up whole universes of intelligence and experience and conscious, subjective space, basically inside our own bodies. There is an intelligence explosion inside our own biology, so much so that a whole universe for exploration opens up right inside of us, and we don't have any need whatsoever to venture out into space to seek contact with other intelligences. We find universes in the grains of sand. And Diana Fleischman just puts a sex robot spin on that and basically says that aliens have never come here because they've made such great sex robots at home, there is no need to go out and conquer the universe. They have fallen prey to fake indicators of fitness. They are too busy with the proximate rewards provided to them by their video games and sex robots to get out into the universe and do anything. And while that's a kind of snarky way to put it, I think it's entirely likely that that is a significant explanation for the Fermi paradox. Where is everybody? Well, they have just discovered more efficient ways to expand their reach, to expand their vision, their consciousness, their experience. They've expanded downward and inward. Because, you know, the barrier of the speed of light and the amount of energy required to travel anywhere near the speed of light and the vast interstellar and intergalactic distances make actually traveling to meet your physical peers a very difficult and very improbable proposition. And Adam described that scenario as aliens haven't come here because they've been just sitting at home navel-gazing. You know, which puts a negative spin on it. I would say they've found better return on their investment by exploring, by looking inward, by increasing the space of potential conscious experience right where they are, and not having to traverse and fill actual physical space. But as I said, I think to Adam, I've talked about this with a few people recently, I think that the Blood Music inward-looking you know, expanding universe on the inside explanation is it's a significant portion of the answer to, you know, where is everybody? But I think another significant portion to that question is the universe in terms of the evolution of conscious technology using civilizations is still pretty young, and we probably are among the first to actually achieve it. And I think we're probably pretty early to the party. I saw a YouTube video about this recently, which from that starting point went on to conclude that in the future, provided humans survive, we will be exemplars to newly evolved species, we'll be teachers of new species, and, you know, we'll be role models for those who come after us. Hopefully we'll be positive role models. All right, it is now Wednesday, September 12th, and I am going to completely delete and obliterate my 9/11 rant that I recorded yesterday and not included in this episode. If it's something you're interested in, well, I'd say get over it. It's really not worth thinking about. Continuing, though, on the sex robot topic and, you know, the topic of sexual politics in general, the interaction between technology, culture, and sex, the effects that disparate male-female ratios have on sexual attitudes and sexual politics. I just rewatched the first minute of the movie Syriana. Quite possibly you've never seen Syriana. It didn't do big business, but it's a film from 2005, and it's sort of a political thriller that takes place in the Middle East. It's written by an actual CIA agent, Bob Baer, I think his name was, and he's played by George Clooney in the film. And it takes place in a fictional Middle Eastern kingdom, but it starts out in a real country, Iran. Bob Baer is at a party in Iran, and there are people, young people, gathered. They're drinking alcohol, and one of them is telling Bob that Tehran is the world capital for liquid MDMA. And the young women at the party are all wearing revealing party dresses, you know, skimpy clothing. They wouldn't look at all out of place in New York or London or, you know, any cosmopolitan place where women are free to do as they wish. But then one of the first things we see is a woman putting on, she's putting on pants, and then she puts on a long coat, you know, over her party dress. And then she puts on a headscarf, and she changes from her high heel party shoes into flat sensible shoes, and then she walks out onto the street. And what we have here is an underground party culture where, you know, Western so-called liberated sexual attitudes are the norm in private, but then out on the street, conservative Islamic norms in terms of, you know, the role of women and the behavior of women out in society, those predominate. So you have a public mode and a private mode. Okay, I mention this because I was just watching a video about mass immigration into EU, largely of young men from African and Middle Eastern countries. Now, we'll set aside the ethnicity and the religion of people, largely Muslims, coming from Africa and the Middle East into Europe, and just look at the fact that the migrants and the newcomers are disproportionately male. If we go back to Diana Fleischman's arguments about, and, you know, the evidence that she cites about the effects that having more men or more women, you know, a majority man or a majority woman mix in a population has on sexual behavior and sexual attitudes, when there are more men than women, women become more selective. They are less likely to engage in casual sex. And when there are more men than women, just, you know, by mathematical necessity, particularly where monogamy is the norm, there will be men who aren't having sex, and these men will be more prone to violent outbursts than men who are having sex. Now, add Islamic values, you know, an increasing number of Muslims in the population, and the demands that Muslim subcultures make on the larger cultures in which they exist in the West, that seems like it might well exacerbate the pressure put on women, largely by women, not to engage in casual sex, to withhold sex, and dole it out only in response to rewards from commitments of monogamy and material resources from men. Now, let's bring sex robots into that picture. What role would they play? I suspect that they would play a similar role that pornography-assisted masturbation plays in the Islamic world today. There are lots of young men who are not having sex, but they are watching porn. And to some extent, this serves as a relief valve. And I can imagine a situation in which you have such strong public attitudes about sexual conservatism that we see what appear to be women in long covering garb, be it a burqa or whatever, out in public. And yet underneath, you know, all of that obscuring drapery, really there's a bunch of super hot sex robots circulating throughout the population, going where they need to go, communicating with one another about who's in need and who's recently been serviced, and basically making sure that all of the young men who haven't gotten off recently get the opportunity to do so with one or more super hot sex robots, traveling in the guise of very conservative, modest women who are covered head to toe. Now, if we have a population of robots, sex robots, who are predominantly female in shape, then that, I think, is going to undo the effects of having more men than women in a population. So I'm thinking mostly here about the near future of Europe, not so much the United States, as the United States, you know, is as uptight as Americans, particularly Americans on the right, get about immigration. Really, we have experienced nothing. Absolutely nothing in comparison to the amount of immigration from Africa and the Middle East into European countries in recent years. The workers that Americans mostly compete with are not workers who have been brought in from elsewhere. I mean, that is true to some extent, but for the most part, American workers are competing with workers who live in poor countries or countries where labor costs are much lower than they are here. So American workers are not so much competing against Chinese immigrants as they are competing against Chinese workers in China. Such is the advantage that globalization throws to capital over labor. But here's another aspect of what Diana Fleischman was describing in the essay that I read at the beginning of the podcast. She says that in populations where men outnumber women, women become more selective in their choice of sexual partners. They become less willing to engage in casual sex, but at the same time, they tend to have more positive attitudes about men. How does that play into the situation where the sex ratios in Europe have been upset by disproportionately male populations of immigrants from Africa and the Middle East into Europe? Women become more conservative in their sexual choices, their sexual behavior, simply as a result of the changing sex ratios, and possibly augmented by the rising cultural authority of Islam in Europe. Of course, powerful men will still be having sex with multiple young, attractive women. A very large population of young men won't be having sex at all. And in general, young unmarried women will be having less sex. I can imagine that for many people listening to this, particularly the younger listeners, that just sounds dystopic and nightmarish. But it probably would lead to a rise in marital commitment, particularly among young people. It may well lead to a strengthening of what has gotten a bad name in the United States, which is family values, basically a family-oriented approach to life and priorities in life, as opposed to an individualist orientation. Granted, it's not a society that I find particularly attractive or that I would even consider, you know, leaving the United States to go and participate in. But much of the air of dystopia that surrounds, you know, my description here stems from the strongly highly propagandized and inculcated nature of our Western individualism and sexual libertine attitudes, you know, that are fairly recent, and which I don't think have been proven to be, you know, unqualified goods for the human experience, you know, unqualified, unreserved benefits to human quality of life in the countries where monogamy and a family orientation towards one's ambitions and one's, you know, life circumstances has been supplanted and replaced with individualist aspirations. We enshrine the rights of the individual in our founding documents here in the West and in the United States in particular, but focusing primarily on our own fulfillment and our own happiness, paradoxically, tends to lead to subpar outcomes in terms of achieving said individual fulfillment and happiness. We tend to be happiest when we are in service to something larger than ourselves. Be it a goal, a social movement, our society, our family, our church community, we achieve individual happiness collectively. And I don't think that that's a contradiction or at all perverse. I think that we achieve purpose, we achieve a quality of life when we focus on something other than ourselves, but I think in terms of our social structures, it is necessary and proper to enshrine and defend the rights of the individual. I think that produces better results than diminishing the rights of the individual in favor of collectives. And you could say that that is a statement of, Western individualist propaganda, but I think it's also borne out pretty consistently when we look at history, particularly the history of the 20th century. But again, what role will robots play in the Islamic world, in the Middle East, in Iran, in Saudi Arabia? You know, as I understand it, while you can be killed in Saudi Arabia for homosexuality, there is a thriving gay scene. I can well imagine that Islam and Islamic authorities will condemn the manufacture, the distribution, and the use of or the ownership of sex robots, and at the same time, sex robots being completely ubiquitous in the Islamic world, to the benefit of the society. Attitudes toward sex robots could be a benign hypocrisy in that respect. They are condemned universally in public and used and enjoyed universally in private for the benefit of the society. All right, to close, I want to read to you just the beginning of an essay on Medium.com. It's called Confessions of a 40-Year-Old Mega Nerd by Rob Bricken, who is an editor at IO9. That is the, I would call it the science fiction nerd segment of the Gizmodo website, but he calls it the pop culture portion of Gizmodo. But if you scroll down through IO9, you're going to see nothing but superheroes and science fiction, you know, skiffy science fiction and nerd culture generally. You're not going to see reality shows. You're not going to see stuff about the Kardashians. You're not going to see stuff about, you know, Jersey Shore or whatever, you know, whatever the contemporary version of Jersey Shore is. Not that sort of pop culture. Definitely Silicon Valley, tech-centric and science fiction-centric pop culture. But Rob Bricken writes, "It happens every day. Like so many 40-somethings who aren't interested in having a heart attack and dying just yet, I take a pill to combat my high blood pressure. Unlike many of my peers, however, when I take this pill at the desk in my home, I do so while surrounded by action figures. Rey from The Force Awakens, Soundwave from Transformers, He-Man and She-Ra. A small horde of characters from Japanese kids' TV shows. I have gotten old, but I have somehow failed to grow up. This is my life, but I can't wrap my head around it. At age 41, I still play video games, regularly watch cartoons, and buy toys and collectibles based on movies and shows I enjoyed when I was 6. The fact that I am a nerd at this age feels wholly unnatural, despite the fact that I've never stopped being one. I've even parlayed this nerdiness into an almost 20-year career, writing about nerd stuff, and most recently as an editor for IO9, Gizmodo's site devoted to pop culture. Despite this, I feel like I've fucked something up, and badly. I've always assumed I would become what I considered an adult. Certainly, when I was young, I expected to get a conventional job and do serious things like watch the news. Even in my 20s and 30s, when I was still devouring comics and cartoons nonstop, I felt confident I would, at some point, leave it all behind to become a capital G grown-up. Even though half my life is over, if I'm lucky and get to the gym more. I'm still in the back of my mind waiting for that moment where I can put away all my toys and comics and actually become an adult. I assumed it was mandatory. After all, every generation before me had left their childish things behind. When my dad was 41 in 1992, he was the operations manager of a steel company, overseeing the tons of metal that went in and out of its giant warehouse. He spent his nights and weekends reading the newspaper and watching slow sports, namely golf and baseball. He was not still collecting baseball cards, as he did as a kid. When my grandfather was 41, back in 1968, he was a civil engineer in Nashville and planned roads and highways all across the country and beyond. I don't know what kids played with in the 1930s, but in all the years I knew him, my grandfather never went to the toy store to buy a new bag of marbles, or brought out his old hoop and stick for a quick roll around the block. Meanwhile, I remain worried that eventually some grown-up is going to notice that I'm still living my best sixth-grade life and stick me in an accounting department somewhere. Please don't get me wrong, I'm not looking for my daily life to change, because then I'd miss out on the 40,000 or so superhero shows currently on the air. I wouldn't have seen the Ultimate Superhero Team-Up movie and the new Star Wars film in the same week. I couldn't read the glut of great comics out there, only some of which involve people in tights. I couldn't be eagerly awaiting new Transformers and He-Man movies, or new Thundercats and She-Ra TV series, or wait. No, that's something I was 100% also doing back in 1984, which only further proves my point. So I'm going to stop there, but this is interesting for me to read because, you know, this guy's talking about being 40 and still being nerdy and obsessed with the things that he was interested in when he was 6 years old. I'm 50. And the first thing that I noticed was, you know, he starts off by saying, like so many 40-somethings who aren't interested in having a heart attack and dying just yet, I take a pill to combat my high blood pressure. I don't take any pills. I don't take any pharmaceutical drugs. I am not on any daily maintenance prescribed to me by a physician, largely because, you know, living without healthcare, I don't see physicians very often. But every time I do, like for that shining moment in New York City when I had Obamacare and went in for a checkup, I had to put my foot down and push back against the doctor who wanted to prescribe me all manner of daily medications. Many of them she wanted me to take simply because I was a man of a particular age. So first of all, what I visualize when I see this man who is in his 40s, who is making enough money to have health insurance. He is writing for a tech site. So I imagine he's in California and that he is making pretty good money. He doesn't seem at all suspicious of authority. He doesn't seem at all uncomfortable in, you know, with his place in the money and power hierarchy in this society. He doesn't seem to have a serious thought in his head. Even though, while I'm not into all the kiddie cutesy stuff that he seems to like, I certainly like stuff that I liked when I was a kid. I'm still into Star Wars, and I'm irritated with the current incarnations of Star Wars, but I will watch the new Star Wars animated series, even though it is clearly meant for a younger audience than the past two Star Wars animated series. And I do still play video games, although I don't have a video game console or a TV like I imagine this guy does. But I didn't read the whole article to you, but I did read the whole article myself, and he never reveals, at least, you know, in this piece, whether or not he is married, whether or not he has children. For me, those two pieces of information are pretty crucial in painting a full portrait of this guy and his relationship to pop culture and technology and adulthood. Now, he says that when his father was 40, his father was an engineer doing serious grown-up things, and that when his grandfather was 40, he was even more grown-up in his activities, and they didn't do anything, you know, childish, or that they weren't still enmeshed with and doing the things that they did when they were children. My dad, when he was a kid, was obsessed with baseball. And while I haven't thrown a baseball in years, I'm pretty good at it because I spent a lot of time out, you know, in the parking lot across the street from where I lived, throwing a baseball with my dad. I played a lot of baseball as a kid, largely because my father was still obsessed with baseball into his 30s and 40s. So I don't think it's necessarily, you know, a universal truth that men of previous generations completely lost touch with all of their childhood obsessions, you know, as they grew into middle age and became adults. And, you know, my father, he worked for the federal government and he worked in law enforcement of one kind or another for most of his life. Definitely very adult. This author talks about how, you know, he's not interested in watching the news, that he's only interested in his, you know, his childish pop culture obsessions. There was a period when I was super serious about watching the news, you know, TV news, and that's when I was in junior high school. You know, in my early teens, I watched the news, the nightly news, every night and took it very seriously and never questioned it, never stopped to ask, what is the motivation? What is the framing of this? Whose interests are being represented here? I took it at face value, and I thought myself very serious and adult for watching the news in that way. And I know adults who relate to the news in that exact same way right now, which I consider to be childish. To think that this is somehow just an objective window onto the world that allows you to see things happening far from where you live, that is the height of naivete, as far as I can tell. To think that that vision isn't distorted by the interests of the people paying for it is delusional and childish. But, you know, I agree. I see a lot of... I don't see them personally. Because here in Bellows Falls, I mean, I've described what I see at length. It's rather pathetic, but not in this way. This is pathetic in the way that, you know, upper middle class tech writers in San Francisco are pathetic in their failure to engage what they consider to be, you know, grown-up interests and pursuits. We have a very different sort of pathetic on display here in rural Vermont. And it does not involve expensive, supposedly child-oriented merchandise tie-ins to pop culture and science fiction and genre entertainment properties. You know, I say, I play video games, and I'm still interested in the sorts of media, you know, that I was interested in when I was young. But I don't buy all that crap. You know, that very expensive plastic crap. One, I move too often, you know, to carry all that stuff with me. And two, there's just nothing about it that appeals to me. There is nothing in me that, you know, no matter how much I enjoy a particular science fiction property, there's nothing in me that says that my life would be better if I were to surround myself with small plastic images from that property. You know, little figurines, posable or not, just sitting on the desk around my computer. And I don't agonize over, you know, not having grown up. Nor do I see my continued interest in science fiction and other genre entertainment as any sort of evidence that I haven't grown up. To some degree, I consider some of the things I watch and consume to be guilty pleasures. But I also see them as largely the, you know, the pleasures in life that my station in life, my station in society, and my station in the history of, you know, the history of the evolution of technology and entertainment affords me. I may live in an impoverished place beset by, you know, criminality and drug addiction, but at least TV is really good these days. Even though I don't actually own a TV, I have access to TV programming. Lots of it, and of unprecedented quality. In closing, you know, tying this all back to the topic of sex robots, it is the author of this piece, you know, people like him will be the ones who will be able to afford and will have the interest in and the interest in sex robots, the ability to, you know, the financial ability to purchase them, and the lowered susceptibility to the psychological effects of the uncanny valley, which is to say they will be less creeped out by the fact that the thing that they're about to have sex with is clearly not human than, you know, most people will be. But I think that will be a very temporary phase. I think that the ability to appeal, I think the uncanny valley will be something that designers of sex robots navigate around very quickly and very skillfully. But the point I'm working around to is this, that in our culture, when you say that some entertainment is adult-oriented, what you're really saying is that it is likely to contain depictions of or references to sexual activity. And at age 50, I mean, I realize that, you know, people have sex well into their 60s and 70s. I am less motivated by sex, less drawn to sexual imagery, less interested in it than I've ever been since I was a child. And to me, so-called adult entertainment is really quite childish. And it is designed to appeal to and to manipulate young people, particularly young men. And it's just odd to me to read the writings of a well-off 40-year-old who is lamenting that his life is half over and that he's old now and still has childish obsessions, because I'm older than he is and go to the gym more often than he does, apparently, enjoy better health and less dependent on pharmaceutical maintenance to keep my body working the way I want it to. And I know many of you are considerably older than 50. And to you, it's even more silly to hear a 40-year-old complaining about being old chronologically and yet still not having grown up. What it really sounds like is that he hasn't fully come into the realization that the whole notion of growing up and, you know, leaving behind childish things is itself a narrative, largely a fictional narrative or an aspirational one. But that is not to diminish the what I think is the very real effect of living in our social media and technology-saturated environment. It allows and encourages us, particularly men, to remain in a childish state well into adulthood. And to be so unfamiliar with what, previous generations considered to be adulthood that we don't recognize it when it arrives, and we continue to wait for its familiar manifestations long after we've actually entered into it. So basically, I'm saying, yes, this culture keeps men in an infantile state, and no, adulthood never was what you were told it was, and you are likely never going to experience it, because it was largely a myth to begin with. Those two ideas seem to contradict each other, but as I forget who said it, the opposite of a profound truth is often a profound truth. Though I'm not claiming to be laying any profundities on you in this podcast. Just keeping you interested and sharing with you the things that keep me interested. Thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing. I will talk to you again quite soon.